powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
This hour of Jake and Stacy is brought to you by the Pro Club. Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross here. Curtis, you asked us a question as part of our show prep. It was very interesting. And let me tell you guys, the last... Now, the time immediately following the game, I went through the following stages. It wasn't like the however many seven stages of grief or whatever. It was like the three stages of loss of a game. And the first was trying to have a measured response. The second was frustration. And the third has now gone into guilt, where I feel bad being angry at Pete Carroll. Not angry with Pete Carroll, frustrated with Pete Carroll. Like, I'm starting to, but you know what? Part of that's a personal thing. In our last segment, I almost apologized to Luke Jokel. So, I mean, clearly this is an unhealthy pattern. No one needs to do it. Pete Carroll's fine. But there is plenty for fans to be upset with. And I think fairly many fans are still really mad. Really mad. Jake, you and I answered the question that Curtis asked. And Curtis, feel free to chime in too, because we all had, I think, similar answers, but I didn't initially agree with you guys. Your question was, did Saturday in the immediate aftermath, meaning his press conferences, represent the first time a majority of Seahawks fans have turned on Pete? My immediate reaction was Super Bowl 49. Everyone was panning Pete. Literally every single person said that will go down as, if not the worst, one of the worst decisions, play calls, in Super Bowl history. And Pete Carroll took immediate fault for that. The difference, though, now that I'm thinking about it a little bit more, is that following that Super Bowl, people, even people that didn't like the Seahawks, even critics, thought that Seattle had a talented enough roster to get back there. The idea was, oh, you blew this chance. It'll be so hard to get back here, but you might.
Yeah.
The difference now is it feels like a lot of that hope is lost.
Well, I think for the first time, and Curtis, as you phrased it to us, is this the first time that the majority of the fan base has kind of turned on Pete Carroll? And I don't know if necessarily in that context, but at least very, very skeptical of the path forward, right? I think that probably is the right way or the right frame to look at it. Is, are there more people skeptical of the path forward to get them farther and advance more into the playoffs, into a Super Bowl? And I think that this text from the 253 is intriguing. I think, yes, more fans have turned on Pete because they are realizing that it wasn't Bevel and it wasn't Shoddy. The offense, in quotes he puts, buck stops at Pete. So when you hear this cut number one, and I listened to this multiple times last night, just trying to really dive into this and really think through this one. This is the one cut from Coach Carroll that I really, really, that really, really strikes me.
As we came on defensively, you know, I mean, I adjusted to some to make sure that we were really taking care of the football, knowing that we could win some games by the way we were playing defense, which is, you've seen us do that for 10 years around here, you know, and that's just the way that we had to adapt. I don't care about the numbers or the stats. That's not what's important. It's fun to have numbers, but we got to win the games.
Do you care about the stats, Stacey? I don't know if I've ever heard you say stats are more important than wins. Curtis, have I heard you say stats are more important than wins?
You have not.
Have you heard me say stats are more important than wins?
No.
Never.
Okay. All right.
I just wanted to
check, because it's never been about stats. It's never been about how many air yards and touchdowns and this, that, and the other that it is. That Pete Carroll is framing that's all the fans care about. It is about, can you effectively put together a winning team, a winning formula that you can get to the Super Bowl, that you can compete with the best teams in the league? And when Pete Carroll says that you took an offense that was the highest scoring offense or had the pace to be the highest scoring offense, you hit a bump in the road and you started to see that your defense was playing better, you predicated your season onto your defense. And if I'm just speaking from that alone, yeah, I probably am feeling more like Dave Wyman on a Monday, being frustrated at the defense for not doing a better job than I am at the offense, because Pete Carroll was relying on his defense to come through for him more than he was the offense. And to me, my question is, why can't you have both? I haven't seen in the rule books of philosophies and ways to win games where you can't have an effective offense and effective defense. And that having a high-flying offense or an offense that can put points up on the board is detrimental to your defense. I get that there are some arguments in terms of time of possession, but what are the Green Bay Packers doing very well? They're putting up points, and they've got great rhythm on offense, and they're trusting Aaron Rodgers to control the show. When the Buffalo Bills were playing the Indianapolis Colts, you know what really, really surprised me? Was that they weren't turning and handing the ball off with 5 minutes left to go in the game when they were up by only a touchdown. They put the ball in Josh Allen's hands because they knew that this was the guy that was going to get them there. So there's all sorts of different philosophies and different ways to manage games. But to me, when it comes down to it, ultimately, I come back to that quote and I come back to that moment of the second half of the season and you deciding to essentially neuter this offense to be able to focus on playing to your defense. That to me is what I have a hard time with.
I want to give us a chance to respond to two critiques I'm seeing on the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line from listeners, the two most common ones. This isn't everyone's, just ones I'm seeing repeat. Number one, okay, but coaches aren't the one throwing picks. Players are the ones not executing. Number two, it feels like this fan base is spoiled and sick of winning all the time. So basically saying you're winning all the time and two, coaches aren't the one. And when it comes to that second one with coaches not the one making plays, that was one of my points post game was, look, Pete Carroll is not the one that you should be giving 100% of the blame to, especially when it comes to the fall off of this offense. Pete Carroll, I think, is a great culture builder, a good team builder, and he wasn't the one throwing picks, but you are the one at the head of the table in terms of making decisions, in terms of making decisions about who makes those game plans and who can question you when they disagree with you. And not to mention you meddled a little bit in the sideline, which you talked about. But so don't put it all on Pete Carroll. But what do you say to people who say, well, players are the ones making plays? Pete Carroll's not out there going offsides or getting a false start on fourth and one.
Of course. Of course. That's always part of it, right? Players have to execute. Russell Wilson in the middle of the season in three games, right? They did not execute the way that they needed to or the way that he needed to and played bad ball. Played bad ball for three games. I should say in the fourth quarter to overtime of that Arizona game, right? And the ability in the Buffalo game and the Rams game, you played bad ball. But with Tom Brady, with Peyton Manning, with Aaron Rodgers, with you could throw Patrick Mahomes in that group, what would those other coaches do? Would they take the reins from those guys? That's what I keep coming back to. So I think that when you look at and third down, people are pointing to third down. Where do you think third down comes from? Do you think third down just happens because, you know, you're able to just execute? It comes from scheme. It comes from rhythm. It comes from timing. And what happened on third down to me is a part of everybody. But you got even worse on third down in the second half of the season, not just because you played great defenses, but because you effectively went conservative with this offense in terms of the tempo that they played with, the creativity in which they played with. And if you look at the beginning of the season, it wasn't just the explosive plays. Everybody focuses on the explosive plays. They play with great tempo. They mixed in screens. They mixed in the run game really well. And they also got Chris Carson involved in the passing game. That was another thing that they did really, really well that they got away from. So you look at all of those things, and the one common denominator was Pete Carroll came right in the middle of it and said, nope, our defense is playing better. We need to play to them. We need to play to those strengths, and we just need to just barely squeak out with wins because that's my formula of winning games. And as I said yesterday, when it comes to always competing, you have to always compete in every aspect. That means Russell Wilson has to look at how he can perform better and how he can be better and how he can be the legit franchise quarterback that we know that he is and can be. and be one of the best quarterbacks in this league. And it comes with this offensive staff. It comes with everybody, but it also comes with Pete Carroll in terms of his philosophy and how do you win games and how can you get back to the Super Bowl? And I just, they have a really hard time thinking that going back and running the football and needing to put more emphasis on running the football is the way that this is going
to
go.
Yeah, you've also got to be able to get the right weapons in place, though, if you're going to turn to the pass. Because what I'm worried about happening is this team instead being like, again, I'm also against that philosophy, but you need to be prepared this time around for teams to respond to you. So what are you going to do? Is it game plan? Is it bringing in more weapons? If you come out, you know, throwing all over the field like you did at the beginning of this year, how long until teams say, oh, no problem, we'll just do what we did against them last year and slow them down? Because they did so very effectively. So what do you have to respond with this time? And I know that for Pete Carroll, that answer is the run game. That isn't necessarily the complete answer to me. I think you open up the immediate pass game, and I know that you've said that, come up with more creative responses, particularly in the pass. But you've got to make some off-season moves to do that because you clearly didn't have the weapons, whether it was game planning, whether it was execution, whether it was players, whatever it was, to respond this year. So I do wonder about that. I mean, I think it still has to be decided. Also, one other thing is people saying, people are complaining about winning. You guys went 12-4 for the first time since you last won a Super Bowl. People are getting tired of winning. I think what I'd say to that is that part of Pete Carroll's philosophy, first of all, Pete Carroll doesn't get tired about winning. Russell Wilson doesn't get tired of winning. And your expectation with this team should be a Super Bowl. Should the Browns be expecting to get to a Super Bowl? That would be fantastic. But I think at this point, most of their fans would be pretty excited with however far they go. And I know that's kind of dismissive, and I don't mean that to be rude. But what I'm saying is a team like the Packers that has been waiting for a decade for their quarterback to get back there and is feeled like they've fallen just short with so much talent, that's a team that's expectation this year is Super Bowl or bust. They are thinking if we don't get to the Super Bowl, this year was a failure. And I think a lot of Seahawks fans feel that way because they've had the talent to do that. You have your franchise quarterback. You've paid him $35 million. You've invested money in not only other pieces of your program, like Bobby Wagner, but also in extending your head coach and now your general manager. Mm-hmm. Presumably, you've got all the key pieces, that trio of key pieces in place. But you haven't been winning forever. You've been winning for 18 weeks, 19 weeks, 18 weeks, 17 weeks. You haven't gone all the way. The expectation should be to do that. That's not being spoiled of winning. I am saying this as someone who, like, never saw my high school team win a football game. Like, trust me, I do not get tired of winning, and I complain all the time about people being spoiled with winning. But that being said, it is not unfair that that be your expectation.
And nor when it is a mantra of your culture, right? The expectation is that. You have a franchise that the expectation is to win Super Bowls, right? Why did Pete Carroll talk about after the game to the press that he has nowhere in his mind, in his brain, for this outcome? He didn't think it was going to happen because the goal and the vision was on a Super Bowl, right? That's the goal and the expectations that you have set here in this town. So it's not that you're not happy with this franchise being successful. It's not that you're not happy with this group going 12-4. That's a great accomplishment. It's a great accomplishment. But when you have the talent that you have, And all of that in place to get knocked out this early against this Rams team that was hobbled and didn't even have a healthy quarterback, yeah, it's a very, very frustrating thing. And to me, it's borderline not okay, right? It's not acceptable. So when you have for five straight years, you have had early exits in the playoffs, I guess there is a point now with the fan base that where is the confidence that this group can actually get past those two rounds,
right?
That can actually get to an NFC NFC championship game, get to the Super Bowl. Where is the vision to be able to do just that? And so that, I think that's the part where the fan base, or it feels like the majority of the fan base is finally, or not finally, I shouldn't say that, is looking at what's going on right now and is questioning whether they can effectively do that, or are we going to see the same story over and over again? And I think that's a legit question to ask.
What's the over-under, by the way, on how many times we're going to hear two high safeties this offseason?
Far too much.
5,000? Over-under 5,000?
Yeah, we're going to hear it a lot.
That's a thousand high safeties.
That's 2,000.
Or 2,000. Jeez.
2,000 high safeties.
It's a lot of them.
Think about it. All right. Time for four down territory.
This is four down territory, brought to you by Mac and Jack's African Amber Ale.
With Jake and Stacy.
We live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
First down, Jake, can Russell Wilson, speaking of two safeties here, can Russell Wilson read and diagnose coverage with two safeties deep in coverage?
Yeah, I heard our own Paul Gallant talk about this and really question the fact if Russell Wilson can read two high coverages. And is he incapable of doing so? And there's a real question, a real doubt that is the case. I mean, come on. Are we serious right now? We seriously think that Russell can't recognize and see too high coverage? I mean, I get that is the defense that over the last couple weeks that you have faced and you have been ineffective in attacking and taking advantage of. But let's go back and look at the plans. Let's go back and look at the wide open receivers. I don't see that. And so I don't believe that this is an inability to recognize and to see too high coverage. If that's the case, you should have never paid this guy $35 million. And that's not based in reality. But what is in reality is you have to have a better plan. You have to have a plan that you can execute at a high level. And when you consistently take deep shots down the field versus a coverage and you're surprised that you can't get guys open or you can't have it or you don't have enough time to allow those guys to get open, it's kind of like Groundhog Day. And so what this group has to do, and that is why Pete Carroll came out on, what was it, Sunday? Monday? It was Monday? And said that...
Monday.
That this group needed to run the ball more effectively versus too high coverage. They needed to have a better plan. They needed to adjust better. Well, you also need to develop a short to intermediate pass game as well. And watch the numbers grow from that point. So I point to the lack of adjustment, the lack of plan, to be able to beat those too high safety coverages. And I am praying that in 2021, through this offseason, they are able to dissect it and they're able to work it out. Because guess what? Defenses are going to run two high coverages versus you next year until you prove that you can stop it.
Oh, hey, Paul. You've actually been summoned to sports court.
Oh!
I've decided that Jake will be seeing you in sports court. We will officially play judge, jury, and executioner in the debate between Jake and Paul Gallant about Russell Wilson's ability to handle a too high safety. I've decided this is the next case on Sports Court. Hit that sound one more time.
Oh.
That's okay. You don't have to. It's giving me life. Yes!
Second down. You only asked for it once. I wasn't ready.
I know. You're right.
Stacy.
It was reckless of me.
What's one issue you have with Pete Carroll's plan to run more in 2021?
It's not just the offensive line that we've been talking about, where I'm wondering if you have the offensive line weapons to really, really be able to do that, because that's a guy that you brought in like DJ Fluker when you said, hey, we're focusing on the run. We're going to draft the best blocking tight end in the draft, Will Disley, and then we're going to bring in DJ Fluker to block for him. So that's outside of even your weapons that you have when it comes to blocking. But how about just your running backs? I mean, if you're going to commit to the run and commit to making that part of how you're going to respond to the way defenses are playing you, which, again, I understand why you're doing that, why not commit to Chris Carson? So you have to worry about leverage there. I know why Pete Carroll wouldn't say, absolutely, we're bringing him back, because then if you're Chris Carson and his agent, you're walking in saying, hey, here's our price tag, by the way. But I really do have some concerns about the way Seattle has been able to draft running backs. Now, I'm going to give some leeway here to DJ Dallas, who was only in his rookie season. And you know what? I'll do the same for Travis Homer, who just in his second year now. But that said, I mean, who outside of Chris Carson has really popped for Seattle? Chris Carson is insanely talented. First 1,000-yard running back since Marshawn Lynch. That doesn't mean he's been the only running back they've really, really tried to make their starter. This doesn't even include guys like Thomas Rawls or Eddie Lacy that they brought in free agency. Alex Collins was one of those guys. Zach Brooks was a guy they brought in. CJ Procise, a guy that they drafted. Christian Michael, a guy that they drafted. You have other guys that they brought in, Travis Homer and DJ Dallas being those two other guys, that haven't been able to be as explosive as him. Carlos Hyde is really promising, but if Seattle wants to go with either a really punishing every down back or running back by committee, I don't know that they have the pieces to really, really have that dynamic of an approach yet.
Third down. Jake, who is the Seahawks player you're expecting to have a big 2021 season?
The player that I'm expecting to have a big 2021 season is the guy that we never saw in 2020. That would be defensive end Darrell Taylor. I believe that this franchise, this coaching staff, this scouting department, believe that Darrell Taylor is the real deal. That they believe that he is Frank Clark-esque in terms of his ability to get after the quarterback, to be able to have that elite twitch, elite power, ability to get to the quarterback. And so if Darrell Taylor can get through this offseason and be healthy and have an opportunity to have a full work in OTAs, I expect Darrell Taylor to have big contributions this season if they can bring back pretty close to the same group that they have with their defensive line. If you have Carlos Dunlap, if you're able to bring back Benson Mayo, I'm not sure if that's going to be possible, but if you're able to have pretty much the same group and you add Darrell Taylor to that mix, man, I think this could be a really, really dynamic defensive line group, and I expect Darrell Taylor to have a really, really eye-popping season in 2021.
Fourth down. National championship game last night. Jake, what was the big talking point that had everyone going?
Well, you look at DeVonta Smith and the game that he had, right? I mean, the Heisman Trophy winner put on an absolute show. But what gave him the ability to do that was actually offensive coordinator Steve Sarkisian was the talk of the town, was the talk around the country about how great of an offensive game plan he was able to put together to get DeVonta Smith the ball and to find creative ways to do that and to do it in a variety of different ways with receiver screens, with sprint outs, with putting him in the slot, putting him on the outside, play action pass. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that Steve Sarkisian got DeVonta Smith the ball. And I believe that when you look at that game in particular, that every receiver, every elite receiver, was envious of DeVonta Smith. You can bank on that. And so I believe that when you look at that ability that Sark showed, we'll see if he can continue that at the University of Texas. But I think it's a great showing that when you have great receivers or you have a dynamic player, you do everything you can to scheme up ways to get them completions in a variety of different ways, and you don't just peg them in one spot and in one role. So a great opportunity for offensive coordinators everywhere to go back and watch that film and saw how Steve Sarkisian was able to do that.
Speaking of that game, there's another thing that stood out. Najee Harris had a great response when asked about his performance against Ohio State. Plus, you guys will not believe how many people watched the Nickelodeon broadcast of that Bears-Saints game. Seriously, and I can't believe that you weren't one of them, Jake. I'm very disappointed. That's next in the timeline.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
Welcome into The Timeline. This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by The Pro Club. Timeline is where we read you guys the top stories you're going to see on your own Twitter timelines. When you see any you want us to include, tag us at JTHeaps9, at Stacey Ross. Let's get started with a look back at Wildcard Weekend because ratings are in for Nickelodeon's special broadcast of the Bears vs. Saints game. That game drew over, Jake, guess the number.
1.6.
Drew over 2 million viewers on Nickelodeon,
wow,
making it the most watched program on the network in 4 years. 15-year-old Nickelodeon actress Gabriella Green, a.k.a. Gabby, was accidentally sent Tony Romo's 800-page game notes ahead of the game, which is amazing. I saw people on Twitter saying, like, oh, these kids, because it was her in the booth, and then a sideline reporter who looked like he was like 12,
yeah,
or something. And it's a kids program, and people were complaining about, like, they just say wow when a ball is punted because they're kids. What do you mean? What are you expecting her to do? Be like, now when you see this slant, what you do is you want to watch the safeties up top.
Cover,
like,
too high. Yeah.
Exactly. What are you thinking?
These people
do?
Are savages. Just let these kids be.
Let
it's on Nickelodeon.
Watch.
Go to CBS.
I thought.
Why
was,
are you watching it?
I thought it was hilarious, and I found a lot of the jokes about it to be funny, but also, like, the product itself was enjoyable. Like, I felt like it would be a good thing to watch if you had kids or if you were watching with someone who didn't know a ton about football.
Yeah.
knowing about football, at no point did it make me like want to pull my hair out. It was clearly for kids.
Yeah, and I think that's great. I think that when you're the NFL and you're experimenting with how do you get more how do you get more fan engagement, obviously you got to start young. You got to start at the grassroots level, and to be able to put a product that kids can enjoy and watch and learn the game, I think it's fantastic. I honestly, I don't see what anybody would have a problem with this. It's just not for me. Maybe when Jackson gets a little bit older, maybe I'll watch the games on Nickelodeon so that he can learn the game a little bit in a simpler version than in my complex brain explaining the game to him. But I think that it's awesome. Why would you hate on it? I don't understand that.
I have no idea. I thought it was also just objectively funny when they would throw to the kids and the kids would have a reaction that just felt out of place, but also was so pure and innocent. Like, hey, Gabby, what did you think about, Mitch Trubisky's pass right here? Yeah, you know, another thing about Mitch Trubisky is his favorite ice cream flavor is chocolate. I thought that was adorable. Oh, anyways, moving on. Alabama running back Najee Harris gave a funny answer when asked about his big game against Ohio State. He was asked what made it look so easy. Here he is in Cut 5.
Najee, Ohio State has a really good front. How are you able to expose those holes so effortlessly?
Effortlessly? You didn't see what they were doing? I was blowing my up. What are you talking about? It wasn't effortlessly. I'll tell you what. Them dude, they did their thing, bro, to be honest with you. It was just, you know, what they did is every time we did a play action, they just shot the gaps. The linebackers, and we got a couple of them to play a lot of the fakes. That's why we were able to throw so much bubbles and the slants and all that. But, bro, they were blowing my up. You tripping?
I love that answer because what that is it's a baited question to get a player to talk about himself and to put him and to talk down his opponent, right? That's what that question is baited for. And I love that Najee Harris, one, he gave a lot of credit to Ohio State, but two, it shows how well he knows the game and how well he is coached because he just went into some deeper football. They shot the gaps. We did this and that to counteract it. I mean, I really, really was impressed when I heard the soundbite. Not only is it funny, not only is it a great reaction and that you're going to have a really fun personality in the NFL here very, very soon, but he's a very good football player who's aware situationally. And I'll tell you this, I saw Najee Harris at the Nike opening when he was in high school as a senior. He was the same exact size then in high school as he is now as a running back for the Alabama Crimson Tide. It was the most absurd thing. It was like seeing a grown man play with little kids. And Alabama just continues to find these guys. It's incredible. But Najee Harris is such a unique back in the sense that, yes, he is big. He's powerful. He's elusive. But that he also is a very, very good back out of the backfield who can catch. And so this is a guy that most running backs now don't really get drafted very high. They always get drafted now to the late first round and the second. I think Najee Harris is going to be a high first round pick.
That comment about Harris in high school just looking like a man surrounded by boys because he was already just grown also makes me think of that video of Andy Reid during the kick and punt. He's like 13 years old. You guys know what
That's
I'm talking
the greatest
about.
Clip. Yes.
I don't know
He's
why.
A foot taller than everybody.
Foot taller than everybody else. And I don't know why thinking about it makes my heart hurt. Like just the idea of just someone being that much bigger who maybe is shy and doesn't want that attention. Do you think he was shy? What am I doing? Yes. Aaron Rodgers told Pat McAfee he's been tabbed to guest host an episode of Jeopardy. As a reminder, he won a celebrity episode in 2015. Cut 6. Here's Rodgers.
They're doing some guest hosting spots, and it's going to be released here pretty soon, but I have the opportunity to do one of those.
Let's go! Did you watch Ken last night? Did you watch Ken?
No, I didn't see Ken last night. I was watching some film and checked in on the college football championship as well for a little bit. But I'm excited about that opportunity with Jeopardy.
Now, I don't know if I just haven't been paying attention. To me, it seems like Aaron Rodgers went from being universally liked to one of the more polarizing figures in football, with people even saying I hate that guy or I love him, he's Aaron Rodgers.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why people wouldn't like him. I personally think he's a great pick for something like this.
Yeah, well, and he's kind of got like a snarky personality, So, you know, I think that, you know, people that get questions wrong, he'll probably give like a little snarky dig at them and stuff like that, which I think is, you know, he brings a levity to Jeopardy. It's pretty cool, and especially when you have unique opportunities like this. Look, they're celebrities. Aaron Rodgers is a celebrity, but still, moments like this are still one of those things where, you know, they grew up watching this, and now they get an opportunity to host Jeopardy. Are you kidding me? That's a pretty cool moment for anybody.
Last thing here, second, really quick, Curtis, Jeopardy is second in your heart only to Survivor.
Correct.
Who would you want to see host from the sports world an episode of Jeopardy if it was not Aaron Rodgers?
Well, I mean, Aaron Rodgers is a great pick.
He's a great
because
pick.
The key to being the host of Jeopardy, and Alex Trebek did this better than, well, he's the only host that Jeopardy's really ever had, is that you've got to be the smartest guy in the room. Aaron Rodgers definitely thinks he's that.
Yes.
So he has that going for him. Other sports people, I mean, Ryan Fitzpatrick, he's got like the highest Wonderlic score ever, right? He's got
to
be.
Yeah, not
there.
Sure if you know, he went to Harvard too.
What?
Which is something not a lot of people know.
News to me.
Yeah.
Another person in the sports world, man, how about somebody from the NBA? Somebody crazy. You
think somebody from the NBA would really be good at that?
Maybe.
Yeah.
There'd be some fun.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to think of a personality that in the NBA that would be great at that.
I think LeBron would be good at it.
You do?
Yeah, I do. Jimmy Butler, maybe?
I don't know.
Oh, Jimmy Butler.
Jimmy Butler
would be
great.
Oh, yes. Jimmy Butler would be good. He's got a lot of just good one-liners to the media that's a good pick.
I want to squeeze in this final story here because there is now a new Twitter fad about it. So the Vegas Raiders announced that Gus Bradley had been hired as defensive coordinator, but there's a problem because the photo that they used is actually of Ken Whisenhunt when they announced the news about Gus Bradley. To their credit, the two men do look somewhat similar, but one is clearly not the other. So now what's happened, Curtis, I'm not sure if you've seen this. Now what's happened is people going around using the original graphic that the Raiders used with just pictures of different people. Like,
nice.
We have hired Gus Bradley. This one has a picture of Adam Gase at his press conference when he's looking around super crazy. Just, I want to see random ones of like Walter White. We've hired Gus Bradley.
How do you make that mistake though?
I think that there was, I saw a tweet about it.
That's
I'm sorry
a big
to tweet
fail.
It
kind
I forgot
of
look alike. There was, they kind of look alike. And there was also an article that had the pictures of the two men together. And I saw a tweet, I'm sorry, I don't remember who tweeted it, that said, I think it was taken from this. And so presumably the Twitter user just grabbed the wrong photo.
Mm.
I'm not sure, but
either way, that's a big fail. Like, I don't care how close they look. I mean, come on. That is the hire that you've made at a very, very important decision in your organization.
Some text coming in on the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line about sports figures who'd be great Jeopardy hosts. 425 says Blake Griffin.
Yes,
I think so.
Blake Griffin. Mm.
Very underrated sense of humor. He's been on a few Comedy Central roasts.
He's so funny.
Yeah.
Have you seen his Hot Ones video?
Yes.
That's also fantastic. I love Blake Griffin.
Somebody's saying Greg Popovich. Do you think Pop would be good?
Mm.
I don't know.
He's
really smart. I think Pop, God love him, would have a couple moments where he, like, instead of making a joke, would be like, you know what, this actually makes me think of an important conversation we need to have.
then the episode becomes a full hour long.
And we're like, wow, I learned a lot, but also I'm still waiting to hear that $800 or 800 points.
Daily Devil?
Yeah. What's going on? All right. We've been talking about Pete Carroll, obviously, all day after a couple controversial comments he made. One in particular about something that he didn't say about Russell Wilson is making people second guess what Carroll thinks about Wilson. Now, I don't necessarily agree, but I want you guys to take a listen. That's next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
The Mariners are set to begin spring training next month, and we're getting ready. Tune in tonight from 7 to 9 p.m. for the Mariners Hot Stove Show, featuring off-season analysis and interviews with Mariners players and coaches. It's the Hot Stove Show every Tuesday from 7 to 9 p.m. Now, we've been talking about what Pete Carroll had to say about this offense for 24 plus hours now. That's not just because of what they did in the second half of the season, but also because of Pete Carroll's comments during his postseason press conference, season ending press conference. One of the things that's gotten a lot of attention from people is him saying, hey, we want to be better and more efficient at the run. And in ways, I think that's been taken out of context because people who want to see Russell Wilson get the ball more often are worried that it'll once again be ball control offense from week one through week 17, and it'll be Pete Carroll trying to lean into a run-first mentality. I don't know entirely if that's what he means. I do think that he's serious about wanting to be more effective against the run. They were hovering around like league average all year, even when they went down in the past. So it's not like they passed less and then ran all over everyone. They were passing for fewer yards and also running for about the same. So right. They didn't become more efficient on one side of the ball at the sacrifice of the other.
Mm-hmm.
But what it's made some people question is whether Pete Carroll doesn't think Russell Wilson can be that player.
Yeah, and I could definitely understand where you take that. For me, I never looked at this as Pete Carroll having an indictment on Russell Wilson's talents. I mean, speaking quite frankly with Pete Carroll or anybody else, the feeling and belief in that building is that Russell Wilson has the chance to be as good as anybody in this league. And they fully have all the confidence in the world in him from that aspect. But it's the belief in the philosophy of how to combat teams throwing out these two high safety coverages and these teams, changing up their scheme or whatever it may be in the second half of the season. To me, ultimately, what happened for the Seahawks team, and to Pete Carroll's point, is you did not counterbalance, you did not attack the weaknesses as effectively as they needed to. And here in cut number three, Pete Carroll points that out, that for him, they need to run the ball to dictate to opposing defenses.
I want to see if we can run the ball more effectively to focus the play of the opponents and see if we can force them to do things like we like them to do more, like we have been able to do that in the past. That doesn't mean we're going to run the ball 50 times a game. It means we need to run the ball with direction and focus and style that allows us to dictate the game. So, I'd like to not play against two deep looks all season long next year.
The problem is that with that conversation is that teams are going to challenge you with that. And they are going to force you into those situations, and they're going to force you to have to run the ball because you just pointed out that that's not what you want to see. And to me, from a passing perspective, as a quarterback, as a offensive-minded person, you never look at too high cover and you go, oh my gosh, we got to play against too high coverage? Are you serious? This is just...
What are these guys throwing these exotic looks around?
It can't be done. No, you can't pass the ball versus too high coverage, and yet they were so ineffective against too high coverage. And so to me, what you look at is you have to develop a better plan in those situations. Yes, running the ball and also developing that short to intermediate pass game. It cannot be feast or famine, and that's what this offense turned into. This offense turned into a group that if you did not get those big explosive plays down the field, you essentially had no offense.
Mm-hmm.
And that can never be the case. You are too talented. You have two very, very talented receivers in DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett. You have a very talented quarterback. You can't ever let that happen again. And so from Pete's perspective, one of those ways is to run the football. I believe that that's probably the more emphasized way in his mind to be able to get that done. And here in cut number four, he reiterates that you've got to kill your opponent by running the football.
If you can allow them to play without their safeties involved, then they get to force the issue downfield and make you have to throw the ball underneath them. And well, that's part of it, but you got to kill them running the football. And that's what historically has been, we never saw two deep teams play us. They couldn't do it. As the season unfolded, it kind of played its way into the style of the defenses that we were playing, and we didn't have we didn't adapt as well as I would like to.
And that is true. That is true. You were not able to effectively take advantage of teams that when they went into too high coverage, you were not able to make them pay. That's bottom line. That is full stop. That was the problem. So now it's not you can't pass the ball. It's how can you put together a run and a pass game that can effectively attack that particular situation better than you ever have done before. That's what they have to come together with, because they have the group that can absolutely shred one high safeties. They have the group that can dominate man-to-man coverage. But this is an area where they need to show growth, and we'll see how they're able to get that done. But my concern is that you put more emphasis into running the football than you do in putting a plan together to make your passing attack more diversified, into putting together an offense that can function at a very high level with a quarterback who can run the show at the line of scrimmage, who can constantly put you in good situations. And they pulled a lot of that stuff from the beginning of the year away from the quarterback in the second half of the year. And I believe that hopefully through a full offseason and through OTAs, they can have more time to practice and emphasize those things that they were not able to during the season, during a COVID year where your practice time and time in the building was extremely limited.
What I've wondered is whether or not Pete Carroll thinks, well, we've got Russell Wilson, and I think he's a great quarterback, but if I want him to be a Patrick Mahomes or even an Aaron Rodgers, that requires building around him as opposed to building around a philosophy that in his mind lets a lot of different players shine. That's too black and white for how it is in reality. But the implication of that is that you don't think Russell Wilson is worth building around.
Well, I don't think it's that. I just think it's more of a philosophy. It's more of the belief that Pete Carroll has in the way that in his mind, in his vision of what you win games. I don't think it has anything to do with what he feels Russell Wilson is and isn't.
When other teams like Kansas City, I'm not saying Seattle needs to be like Kansas City, and I don't think people are saying that. I know you're not saying that. But other teams have effectively been able to have a team geared around some of their greatest assets and also good defenses.
What do they have at the top, though? What do they have at the top?
Well, they have different schemes.
They have not just schemes, but different leadership.
Okay.
Right? So Aaron Rodgers has Matt LaFleur. Before that, he had Mike McCarthy, two offensive-minded head coaches. Patrick Mahomes has Andy Reid, an offensive-minded head coach. Drew Brees, Sean Payton, right? You see the commonality here. So I'm not saying that Pete Carroll needs to go. That's not what I'm saying from this conversation. But what I'm saying to counteract what you're saying about, you know, Pete Carroll not wanting Russell Wilson to be like Patrick Mahomes is because inherently he doesn't believe in an offensive philosophy needs to be that way. The only guy who's gone against the grain and has gone against their original philosophy to build a high-flying offense is Bill Belichick. That's it. That's the only guy, a defensive-minded head coach who has looked at his offense and looked at Tom Brady and said, all right, we need to change the way that we play the game, and we're going to go full tilt on the offensive side of the ball, and that's how we're going to build our team. That happened at the beginning of the year, and they pulled back mightily once Pete Carroll saw the saw the turnovers, and number two, when he saw his defense really turn things around, that's what got him to pull back even more so and say, hey, we can win games just based off of the way our defense is playing.
All right, NBC Sports Northwest, Joe Fan is going to join us next. I'm going to ask him this question, whether he thinks anything Pete said was an indictment on his own quarterback. He also has a column on three of the Seahawks' signature flaws that showed themselves again in that loss to the Rams. We'll ask him about that next on Jake and Stacey.